Good evening, you all. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My call is. My handle is Dick. And it's time of beginning the technical mat. Technical mat number 1465 of the series that began in September of 1982. There are four guys now who are CodeNet control people. Me, John KC2WGB, who handles our mailbag. Paul WS2N, who tells us what NASA is doing. And K6DPZ, who's giving us examples of how to make more brief statements. Hal did think last week that the monologue that I give in the beginning, explaining what the TechNet is, he thought that I took 45 minutes last week. And I went and checked 2 weeks ago, read back the tape recording. And by the way, every one of the tape recordings for the last 7 years, all TechNets are recorded. And you go to Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI is the call letters of the guy who's doing this. And you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. You select the right month, the right week, and listen to the recordings of that particular TechNet. So 2 weeks ago, my monologue lasted for 10 minutes and 40 seconds, and that includes the sign-in time for people who signed in. We figured out what their real call letters are and name was. Last week, the monologue took 6 minutes and 40 seconds, including the sign-ins. I know that for you guys who have heard the so-called monologue Saddam many times, it may seem very long to you because you know it all, you've heard it all many times. It's sort of required, though, because John and I get a fair number of letters from people who have just discovered, let me drop them. They using their scanner, talk to a friend or whatever, and suddenly discovered the TechNet, started listening to it, and said, what is this? And so they need a little bit of a piece of information as to if they make the investment to spend the time to listen, what are they going to get back out of it? And there's an amazing number of people who, after 31 years, have suddenly discovered that there is something called the technical net, even though they've been on 2-meter FM repeater operation for all these years. There's a menu that we follow over the 31 years of the TechNet. It slowly evolved from what used to be 1 hour's worth, and then it became 2 hours, then 3 hours, because people were complaining there's not enough time. And now it runs 4 hours. It starts at 8 o'clock and ends at midnight. At my request, the machine gets automatically turned off at midnight because some of these guys get so enthusiastic they would go until the sun rises. And some of us have got to go to work the next day. There's the menu that we finally settled on so far, and it's continuously evolving, is that the first hour, hour and a half, we take people's check-ins, they give us their questions, and we try to give them a quasi-brief answer. We don't go real deep, but and we do that later on. That's followed by Paul at WS2N giving us the report on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing. And after the mailbag and the NASA report, the next thing that happens is that we go into deeper subjects. And not everybody is pleased with that. There are people who think ham radio should be, you know, lay back and enjoy it. Why worry about the details? And there are other people who really want to know what's going on at the molecular level of a transmission line or an antenna and so on. We get into those kind of subjects. And if that doesn't please you, be forewarning that's going to take place. I have over the last year, on and off, and particularly the last 3 weeks or so, been complaining about the fact that the Limark logo appears on a notice that tells you about the TechNet, and that notice has, for approximately a year, said that it begins at 8 o'clock and ends at 8 o'clock. I talked to quite a few people to try to get that corrected. This week, it finally got corrected. Talked to Rich and to PPN, who made the correction. And it's 98% corrected. It now says it starts at 8 o'clock and ends at 11:30. It really aims at, it really stops at 11:59 and 59 seconds, but close enough. It's a lot better than the zero time it used to have, starting at 8 and ending at 8. One other thing I'm going to tell you. During this week, there were a number of astronomical events that were fairly interesting. If you go to a website called Heavens Above, and you can find out what satellites and what space launchings and whatever would be observable from your home location, and week there was at least two International Space Station flyovers that gave some very bright flashes. There was an Iridium satellite that gave a very bright flash. There was a launch of a space vehicle that the Pole will be telling us about, and a number of people saw those. So we had these gatherings at around 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night during the week because of these astronomical events. And because these astronomical events gathered the right people, some of them stuck around and continued discussing things like what telescope they're using, where they go to do observing, what clubs they're a member of, and so on. And so there's a gathering group of people who realize that they need an astronomical net. And there's talk going on right now as to whether or not there'll be a completely separate net on, say, Tuesday night that is strictly astronomy, or whether or not there'll be another section of this net that's dedicated to astronomy after Paul's talk, for instance. And I kind of hope that takes place, but it's their choice. KG2T and other guys who have been pretty heavy into astronomy for the last 3 years, I think Joe owns something like a 16-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain. I think it's a Celestron telescope. A little bit on the heavy side to transport, but boy, can he do some viewing with that. And the biggest telescope on Long Island that is privately owned. Let me drop it. The biggest telescope on Long Island is the one that's owned by John Vogt. John Vogt is one of the prominent members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASLI. And he has a 33-inch diameter mirror telescope. I'll bet you that mirror is a good 150 pounds just for the mirror itself. And this is a portable telescope. He takes apart, puts it into his van, and takes it wherever. And that is homebrew. He ground that mirror with his own hands twice. The first one he ground, a special piece of glass made for him by Corning, cracked somewhere in the process and had to start all over again. So that's a telescope. And just to look through the eyepiece on this Dobsonian telescope, you have to stand on an A-frame stepladder, and you get about 10 feet above the ground. Your head's about 10 feet above the ground when you're looking through his eyepiece. And Jeff, I've heard you say, as you guys have heard me say from time to time, we make jokes about the fact that after you look at a star through John's telescope, you have to use a parachute to get back down. That's, of course, it's an exaggeration. So there is a possibility that the TechNet will have a astronomy section at a later time. It's in the talking phase right now. Okay, you now know the menu. You know what's going to take place. Now's the time for the check-ins. And you need that check-in to say you're listening. Because after 31 years, we believe somebody is listening. Let me try. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Some nets are very interesting. Some nets are a little bit boring. And it isn't necessarily the fault of the four people who are trying to run the net. It's a function of what questions do you guys ask. 90-some-odd% of what we discuss is a function of your questions. So if it ain't interesting enough, then think of some more interesting questions. So a typical sign-in would sound like this, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K-2-R-I-W and the TechNet.
K-C-2-M-D-P, Steve, and yes.
Comment. I'm after running with somebody.
Okay, I heard both Steve and Joe. So we got Steve and Joe, not to worry. And there was at least a triple in there. Who was the other person? Okay.
Good evening.
I heard somebody say good evening. If you have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters right now and your name. Who else would like to check into the TechNet with a real question or a comment? K2LIW listening.
Ken CEO, good evening, Rich.
Glad to hear you, Rich. Okay, so Massapequa is back on the air. Massapequa Park, which is Rich's new QTH. He's now back at home from the Rehabilitation Center. Signal's just a little bit noisy, but once you get around to putting a real antenna on the top of the roof of that house in Massapequa Park, you should be fine business, Rich. Glad to hear from you. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo, Gabe, comment.
WS2N Ball, Weather Space Report. Good evening, fellas.
Okay, we got Gabe, we got Paul. Now, let's see, that's that one. Hey, one last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or comment? Give me your call letters. K2RIW.
This is
Queen Yankee Whiskey, slightly noisy, Joe with an O. We got more than enough to keep going. Steve, KC2 Mike Delta Papa. How are those electrons that try to radiate? How are they treating you these days, Steve? KC2 MDP, K2RIW.
They're doing me pretty good over here. Can't complain. Everything seems to be working. Dick Tide, I got a question on switching power supplies. A friend of mine brought this to me last night, and it's it concerns a switching power supply. Now, this thing, I haven't seen it yet, but it looks like basically like a switching power supply from the computer. It does, it's for video surveillance cameras. And basically, it looks like a computer power supply, and it's just got like 16 terminals in this thing. It's 10 amp, and I do believe each of the 18 is like half an amp a piece or so, maybe a little under a half an amp. Now, the problem he's having is he do believes that that this thing overvolted the cameras and basically burnt them out, but he said when he did a test on them, he was getting 12 volts. Is it possible that switching power supply under some kind of load would boost the voltage? Back to you, Dick.
I think the answer is yes. It's a little bit on the rare side, Steve. Most of these switching power supplies have the equivalent of a choke input filter. The switching takes place at usually an ultrasonic rate or a low RF rate. Let me pick a number. 200 kilohertz could be the switching rate. And by changing the on-to-off ratio, the pulse width modulation, that's how it adjusts the output by, say, for instance, the real raw supply inside after it rectifies 110 volts might be, let me pick a number, 150 volts. And then by having a on-to-off ratio that is a few percent, 150 volts could be brought down to an average of 12 volts, and after the filter you get a beautiful 12 volts output. And as you add a load to that power supply, the 12 volts goes down to 11, we'll say. The power supply senses that, and it starts increasing the pulse on to off duration in order to bring the voltage back up. So if you had a complete failure of some designs of switching power supply, if, in other words, it went into the full switching on mode instead of a very low duty factor of on to off ratio, in theory, it could give you a pretty fierce voltage, like 150 volts. One particular design can do that. Many of them have a crowbar circuit. Let me drop it. Many of them have a crowbar circuit. It's a completely separate circuit which will sense, let me pick a number, 15 and a half volts. And if the 12-volt supply goes to 15 and a half or above, it turns on a silicon-controlled rectifier, which presents a short circuit, and brings that voltage back down so as to protect your hardware. So the better-made power supplies do have that overvoltage protection network. So did it do that sometime in the past because the power supply was in a hot corner of the room with the sun shining on it and went into a failure while it was overheated, and now that it's back to normal room temperature under more ideal conditions, it's back to normal operation. That's a possible scenario. So many... even linear regulation type power supplies start off with a raw voltage of 25 volts, which gets regulated down to 12 and a half. And so even one of those can go into a failure mode that'll put out 25 volts, and a circuit that's intended for 12, getting 25, might be damaged. So can a switching power supply give you more grief than a non-switching power supply? That's a good point. Usually under load, they don't go into overvoltage. And many of them will have a current limiting circuit in there that beyond, if it's rated for 10 amperes and you try to draw 11 amperes, it'll jump down to a much lower voltage. Many of the good designs do that. In the case of a computer where you've got a whole lot of expensive integrated circuits in there, particularly the main microprocessor, you want to have a number of kinds of protection, overvoltage protection, overcurrent protection, and whatever, so as not to burn up a whole lot of silicon in your computer. So the better-made computer power supplies have got those protections. Whether or not your particular one does is something for you to do some research. When you find out the model number and the brand name, hopefully there's a way you can get a hold of a schematic and or repeater. Time out. Hopefully there's a way you can get a hold of the owner's manual and or schematic and find out some more about it. And if you want to be a super conservative person, there's lots of ways that you could put light bulbs and resistors and all kinds of things as a demi-load on the power supply and do a lot of bench testing to be sure you're happy with the way it behaves before you connect it to your valuable piece of electronics. Drag your feet a little bit, Steve, when I pass it back to you, because there's quite possibly more people in the New York City area who have got switching power supply experience, particularly the kind of switching power supply that's in a computer, because that's where you believe this one came from. And so if one of those people want to sign in and tell us any more information, we'd appreciate it. KC2MDP with some delay. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
This is DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Okay, just wanted to mention on the switching power supply. Switching power supply has a system just like an AVC and a receiver. When a large signal or higher voltage comes through, a return loop changes the pulse width modulator that drives the switching power supply. You may have had a transient that came through that the ATC or the leveling circuit that samples the output did not catch it, and that's why you may have a surge in voltage to cause some problems. We suggest that clamping the supply off of the fuse and the zener, where if it reaches a certain point, and the zener fuse a little bit higher than your load you're going to be handling. And this will give you a little added protection. That's my simple comment, K6DPC.
Yeah, I like the sound of that, Hal. So to be super conservative, if you get yourself a relatively high wattage, let me pick a number, 15 ampere zener diode, with a heat sink on it, and put that on the output of the 12-volt supply. Now you're double darn sure that you're not going to go above 15.5 volts on that zener, because it'll then go into a short circuit and limit what voltage you get out. And the zener will also protect you from reverse voltage, because the zener, 15.5 volts in the forward mode of the zener, it starts conducting. And with anything more than about 1 volt in the reverse mode, it'll conduct. Hal, let me give you one suggestion. You were jumping out of the computer because of high deviation on that last transmission. Your mic gain might be set kind of high because you were putting out square waves of audio. We heard everything you said, but there was the characteristic distortion of a speech processor that was being overloaded. As I said, you were jumping out of the repeater with deviation. Okay, Steve. You now got a little more information about switching power supplies, and you're allowed to ask more questions about it because we're all dependent on those. KC2, MDP. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Thanks for the info. Yes, I was thinking of doing some tests on it, and I'm glad you brought up the point with the light bulbs, because that was basically my idea to put some load on this thing and see what happens. Like I said, I haven't seen it, and probably either tomorrow or Tuesday I'll probably look into this. So I'm thankful for the information, greatly appreciate it, and I'll get back to you next week to let you know what happens. Thank you very much, Dick.
Good luck with that project, Steve. Joe, how's the world of electronics and radio in particular treating you? I know you were at one time involved in a very difficult search of these defective frequency synthesizer modules that became microphonic. And because you showed me one of those, because it's such an extremely tight assembly, where if you shake the board, you're shaking every single component on there simultaneously, including the crystal reference oscillator, which is cemented down to that board, so to speak, so tight that very difficult to isolate. But I know that's a tough one. Back to you, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW, and the Tech Man.
Good evening, Dick. That's not what the question is. those things are just sitting in a box collecting. I've got about maybe 60 or 80 of them so far. They're just throwing in numbers. Anyway, my question is, I've had a discussion with somebody that says there's apparently two different systems for with solar systems for power for houses, and you can't combine these things at all. One system will basically produce power, which you can feed back into the grid, and it'll also power your house. And the other charge batteries, so at night you can run the battery. The batteries will run backwards to an inverter to run your electric in your house. Have you ever thought of any kind of way of joining something like these type of dimensions together, where at night you could take a system and get cut it off the grid and you go onto something your, either your own, running off batteries and all that? I mean, is this a doable type of thing, or have you ever given a thought or something like this? Because apparently it's not made commercially. They make either one type of system or another type of system.
I can see how the vendor would try to sell one type or the other and lead you to believe that you can't mix them and that you have to have both functions. He's going to try to talk you into selling buying two separate systems from him. I can see how that might take place. When it comes to thoroughly independent power supplies for a house and running it on solar voltaics, arguably the expert in our area is Dennis, NY2HF, November Yankee 2 Hotel Foxtrot. And last week he was telling us, or the week before, he was telling us quite about his system. He's got quite a number of square meters of solar voltaic cells that go into a system that boosts the voltage up to 60 cycle AC. He has the ability to pump it back into LIPA. That's the good news. However, the way the system is designed, and because he's at the tail end of LIPA, way out there in Cutchogue on the North Fork, he's not very far from Montauk Point, as such, the voltage out there is sort of like the tip of a whip, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. Now, the tail of the dog out there, or the tail of the fish of Long Island, really gets wagged, so the voltage out there comes up to some pretty high and pretty low numbers from time to time. We out here in western Suffolk and Nassau, we don't have anywhere near the excursions he experiences. And the way his system is designed, that if the voltage being supplied by LIPA is outside of a desirable window, in other words, if it goes too high in voltage or too low, his system automatically switches off and no longer gives him the ability to pump power back into the line. So he's got that problem. And whether or not he's able to charge the battery some of the day and pour the power back when he's not using it, or charge his batteries and use it to run his house at some other time, I'm not quite sure of those details. Let's hope that Dennis does sign in tonight, because he's a guy with hands-on, hard experience. He's got, I'm guessing, 6 months or maybe even more experience of actually running solar voltaic substantial power system. I think he told us last week, on a good day, he can develop something like 40 kilowatt hours, if I remember, is the power that he can generate on a good day. And I'm guessing that although LIPA probably charges him a certain rate when the power flows toward him, and a slightly lower rate when the power flows from him to them, I'm guessing now he has the ability to build up enough of a system to break even, which is his electric bill goes to nearly zero, except for the monthly connection charge, if you know what I mean. Let me see if Dennis is on frequency. I hope he is. NY2 Hotel Foxtrot. I wonder if you're there, Dennis. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. NY2HF. Yes, I think the lowest bill I've had so far with LIPA was $7. We haven't got it to the point where we're not using them at all, but we have a large house here, and I'm constantly buying more LEDs to bring all of the costs down for the lighting. So, I do have batteries. I have about 20 deep cell batteries that run through a 2400 continuous inverter and can surge to 4800 watts for backup, but right now it's for emergency backup. It's not for running the lights at night. They're making a lot of progress in the batteries that they have, but they're expensive. They have a limited lifespan, so right now I'm sitting tight. The next thing I want to do is put a wind turbine up. And that way I can probably cancel out what happens at night. Back to you, Dick. Back to the net.
That's very, very good information from you, Dennis. But now let me try to reword what I think is Joe's question. He is led to believe that when he buys a solar voltaic system, he can either buy a system that charges batteries to run his equipment, or he can buy a system that is capable of taking the solar voltaic power at high noon, we'll say, and pumping it back to LIPA. And he's led to believe that he's not at least the particular vendor he's talking to doesn't seem to have a mixed system. In other words, a system where he could some of the time be charging a battery and some of the time be pouring back power to LIPA, that so-called combination system he thinks is unavailable. Maybe that's a particular vendor with a particular story, and I'll bet you there's a lot more to it. I wonder if you can add some words to that one, Dennis. NY2HF, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QAQ, attendant.
Glenn recognized, but Dennis first. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. Actually, I'm not sure. I do know that there probably needs another component added. It's not where you crash the inverter. The inverter, or singular or plural, the inverters. But you have to add other things because you have to, feed it into charging the battery banks. So you're going to step it down or whatever's going to happen. So, yes, probably there's something that you need to add on. I don't know that they have the end-all and be-all, but we started this. We've actually had this solar now for probably, I don't know, 6 years. So we have the older type where if you get a shading on one of the panels, it knocks the whole grid out. But if the new ones with the microprocessors and the microinverters, you can put shading on one part of it, and it doesn't knock out the whole grid. Everything else is
very fine, Dennis. Dennis, I can tell, is coming into the eastern input of the machine, 147.375, and on that machine, he is nearly dead full quieting. There used to be a internet connection between the two machines, which occasionally developed significant amount of latency, delay time, sometimes quite a few seconds. And since Eric has established a radio link between the two, there now is zero delay. Any voice on either machine comes out of the other machine when they're linked in zero time. That's the good news. However, at Glen Oaks, the radio link is being subjected to some very local, direct sequence split spectrum hardware, which occasionally is putting glitches. You hear what sounds like a noise, but it's really glitches being coupled into the audio that when somebody's on the 375 machine and you're listening to the 85, you're hearing some clicking sounds that sounds like noise. So it's not Dennis's fault. And it's an area that Eric is continuing to work on, and that's going to be improved, so hang in there. Glenn, I bet you worked on some solar voltaic systems. I bet you're very tempted to add one to your house. And I think you're in Massapequa, and you probably know there's another ham in Massapequa Park now, at 2EO. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW. Tell us anything about that subject, Glenn. You got it. Huge improvement. What did you change and what do you think happened? go ahead and repeat your message when you want to. Over to you, Glenn.
I was just looking at my power setting, and okay, there we go, right there. Yeah, I had the power setting very, very low before, but hopefully this should be a little bit better.
You're now dead full quieting. Right before you were 95% noise. Boy, is that an improvement. So go right ahead with your message.
Okay, basically the point I was making is that the design of the two systems, they are very different. One to charge batteries, and one basically to feed the grid. And the idea there is, it's how much power you have available in the cells. So in other words, what will happen is if you have X number of panels on your roof, let's say you have 40 kilowatts worth of panels, and if you're going to charge batteries, it's going to take a certain amount of energy to bring those batteries up to charge, which would leave nothing left for the grid during daylight hours. And if you're basically going to charge the grid, then there's nothing left for the batteries. So it's kind of either one way or the other. In other words, it depends on what you're trying to do. So if at one point in time you want to use the light to charge your batteries, you'd have to somehow tell the system to, you know, switch over to just charge batteries. And then at another time when you want to try to backfeed the grid, you'd have to backfeed the grid. But unless you had almost, you know, an infinite amount of panels, it would be very difficult to accomplish both. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Sound good information, Glenn. Can you sound real good now? On the assumption that Glenn is either, that Joe is going to either buy or build a system, to your knowledge, is it possible to build a system where he's got a knob, and as Joe twists that knob, he can decide that today 50% of the power that I'm generating from my solar cells is going to go into charging my batteries, and the 50% left over is going to be poured back to LIPA in order for me to get some money back. I am guessing that during the heavy usage time of the day, that when you pour power back into LIPA, if you get the right kind of a meter, that they'll give you a bigger benefit in dollars per kilowatt hour at, say, high noon, on a hot summer day when everybody's running air conditioning and voltage is very valuable, so to speak. I'd like to believe they pay you more than if you pour power back to them at midnight. So with the right kind of a knob on the system, you could decide how much battery charging and how much LIPA power you're going to pump back. To your knowledge, is there a commercial system that he could buy with that knob? And if not, could he modify a commercial system to do that? And if he's building his own system, I'll bet you he's smart enough to be able to create that knob, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ. Am I way off base here, Glenn? K2LIW in the tech man.
You're not way off base, but basically what that system would entail is this. The solar cells could be up on the roof in one array of panels, and that's basically the common point of the system. Then after that, they generate a DC voltage, which that DC voltage could be anything from 12 to 72 volts. Now, you need if you're going to be charging batteries, you need the system that basically regulates that voltage to charge up the batteries. That's a buck boost converter and charger. So basically when the voltage is low on the panels, it boosts the voltage up to charge the batteries, and the voltage gets high, it limits it and bucks it back a little bit. So it keeps the batteries in as close to a constant charge as possible. That's one system. Let me let it drop. The second system is the grid inverter. It basically does the same thing. It takes the same basic panel from the panel voltages and basically converts them basically up to an inverter and supplies the grid power. My suggestion to Joe is basically he buys both systems. Now it has one set of panels, but has basically two systems. And what he can do is at the circuit breaker panel where these things are attached, he can make a crossover switch right there, like a soda switch. So basically, when he wants to charge his batteries, he basically just throws the switch at the circuit breaker panel where the inverters join in and basically go on the battery system. And then when he wants to go back to the grid system, he clicks it over the other way. So basically, he's either using one or the other. But as it's mainly due to the power limitation of the cells, you're not going to have enough panels to do both simultaneously. KC2QIQ.
NY2HF with a comment.
Dennis recognized. I see the possibility of some real good design here. And let me run this one by you, Glenn. After I do my speculation, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis, and then after Dennis, you're going to come back to you, Glenn, to find out whether or not I'm way off base. If this is the best of all worlds, I'm going to convert my whole darn roof of my house into solar voltaic cells and maybe a few more panels in the backyard. So I got lots and lots of kilowatt hours of solar input. 4.3 million watts of solar energy is hitting my 1 acre of property in Huntington at high noon right now. 4.3 million watts, was it 4.2? If I could gather 1% of that, 42 kilowatts, I wouldn't know what the hell to do with it all. So if I have enough solar voltaic cells and I got the right kind of a switching regulator between the raw voltage coming out of the solar voltaics and my batteries, I could decide to charge the batteries at near maximum efficiency all the time. I could possibly have the ability to fully charge my batteries, at which case I don't want to continue charging them. You overcharge your lead acid cells, for instance, and nothing good happens. And there I would pour all the power back to LiPo. Let me drop. On top of that, I'm going to speculate that LiPo would give me more dollars per kilowatt that I pump back to them at the time when they've got heavy usage. I'm going to make a guess that maybe you can make a deal with them that between 10 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, when everybody's air conditioning is really cranking, is when they're going to give you the maximum dollars. Therefore, it is possible with that ideal system I'm describing, where between sunrise and 10 o'clock in the morning, you pour every bit of the power you've got into your batteries because LiPo doesn't pay you as much. Then from 10 o'clock to 4 in the afternoon, you pour a substantial amount of your solar voltaic power back to LiPo and get paid for it. And then anything left over beyond that, you charge batteries again if they hadn't yet come up to fully charge. And now you've also got some possibilities of using LiPo power at nighttime because it's cheap enough and don't even bother discharging your batteries. There's various combinations you can do here if the system has enough switching regulated going between the solar voltaics and the battery charging system, and enough switching regulation between the batteries or the solar voltaics and the way you generate 60 cycle power back to LiPo. So with the right kind of switching regulators in both cases, I think it's possible to have your cake and eat it too. Maybe I'm dreaming, but Joe's a smart enough guy, I think he could create that if he wanted to bad enough. I'll bet you Dennis has dreamed about things like this. NY2HF, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. Well, first off, LiPo pays you less than what you are charged for the electricity. So that's number one. So that's diminishing returns. Number two, right now I have the capability of doing what I believe Joe wants to do, because I can charge the batteries through the inverter. I can also equalize the batteries. It's a 48-volt system. 24-volt system. I can also charge the batteries during the day and use them at night, but I haven't used it that way so far, even though I got a gang box and everything else. I've got it set up for when we get these hurricanes and blackouts and maybe an ice storm, so that I can run my pellet stoves, I can run my LED lights, and whatever else I have to hook up, because that's enough power to get by. So actually, Joe might want to think about doing something like that, where he sets up an inverter with a battery bank, not the high nickel cadmium and whatever else is out there, but just deep cell batteries so that he can get through a rough spot. Because right now they don't have the technology that has a long life, so it gets very expensive. Back to you, Nick.
The part you are saying is expensive, I'm guessing, is that if I wanted to generate a whole lot of kilowatt hours for 2 solid weeks to run my house during the time a Hurricane Sandy comes along, I'm guessing that that amount of battery storage would be very voluminous and extremely expensive, and batteries like that, even deep cycle batteries, I'm guessing that the 300th time that you deeply discharge those batteries, I'll bet they're coming down in ampere hours. Is any of those guesses of mine close to being on target, Dennis? NY2HF, K2RIW?
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. one thing that you could do is, and I've heard this from other people that I've been talking to, and I'm really tempted to do it, is to fool the inverters that you have the panels on the roof. And when life is down, you can't use it. But you can fool the inverters into thinking that LIPR does have power by shutting off the main house supply, so there's no threat of a lineman being electrocuted from power going down the grid when he thinks there's no power there. But you could put a pure sine wave inverter on the other side of the total throw circuit breaker and fool the inverters into thinking that LIPR is there. So you could use your power during the day to run certain things, but also charge your batteries. That's something I'm still playing with, and I'm trying to get more information on. Back to you, Ned.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. You're the greenest guy I know, Dennis, where you've got a serious photovoltaic system capable of pouring substantial amounts, you know, 30 or 40 kilowatt hours per day. You can decide to use yourself or pull back to LIPR. Very few people on Long Island, I think, have anywhere near that capability. I'm going to make another guess, Dennis, and that is, if you took some of your extra dollars that you've got right now and decide to put up more solar voltaic panels, either on your roof, if there's any square feet of your roof left, or on solar voltaic panels somewhere in the yard, so to speak. And if you look at the payback you get from solar voltaic versus a windmill, it is my gut feel that windmills are very cost-effective if and only if they're very large, the 100-foot diameter wheel-type thing, propeller-type thing. I believe the power output you get from a wind generator is in the vicinity of diameter of propeller, the wind generator diameter cubed, I think, is the proportion. So until you make a very large one, I don't think you get very many dollars of return on investment by comparison to solar voltaic. I bet you've already started doing some of those comparisons. And I'm guessing that when the comparison is done accurately enough, deep enough, I think you might be ahead of the game with more solar voltaics as opposed to a wind generator, until you're willing to put up a wind generator that's very large, in which case I think you might run into some zoning problems. These are a bunch of guesses on my part, Dennis. NY2HF, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Well, once again, you're correct, Dick. If you put up a very large wind turbine, you will run into zoning laws right here. They say if the towel was to fall over, it can't be I'm on 3 acres of land, so I'm not worried about that. Well, what I have done is I keep saying this throughout, all of these deep cell battery systems, where fishermen are throwing these batteries out because somebody told them that, at the end of every season, to discard them by you because you don't want to get stuck out in the water. But they're discarding perfectly good batteries. And I'm monopolizing on that. So, along that line, I've taken some of these magnet motors out of very large commercial treadmills, like 11 amp or something. So I can run several turbines that will work 24/7 if the wind is there, unlike the solar. So I can actually enhance my battery backup if I choose to tap into it. Back to you, Nick.
Interesting. Glenn, I drove up and down your street, and I actually saw your house about a month after Hurricane Sandy, because I did a survey, so to speak. And my guess is, if you wanted to put up a good-sized wind generator in Massapequa, where you live, I think you'd run into a fair amount of flack from your zoning board. And you're good enough at being friendly. I think you could talk your neighbors into it, but I think your zoning board would give you a flack. However, I bet you dreamed about putting up some substantial solar voltaics on your property. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay,
look, I still have about 2 kilowatts worth up on the roof, but it's still been there. I've made it through all the hurricanes and everything. They were high and dry, so no problem there. And the batteries were in a relatively safe location. So that, I'm speaking to you on solar panel power right now. So, that's all okay. But as far as the turbines go, something to look at that's a little bit more reasonable is Honeywell makes a 1 meter fan assembly with a regulator and inverter for basically home generator power. And the 1 meter turbine is approximately about 5 kilowatts of output. So if you were to mount 4 of them, one on each corner of the house, that gives you approximately 20 kilowatts, which is fairly reasonable. And, 1 meter, heck, I've seen people with more than 3 or 4 dishes on their house. So I don't think you'd have too many problems with the zoning boards on that. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
NY2HF, what a comment. I'm
going to claim.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to the dentist in a minute. Something is wrong there, Glenn. 1 meter diameter, a little bit more than 3 feet in diameter. You said 5 kilowatts. Wow. In a 50-mile-an-hour wind, maybe. But what's the minimum wind speed required for a 3 meter fan to give you 5 kilowatts of output? I don't think the wind blows that hard that often in your neighborhood. Maybe I'm wrong. KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
What I would suggest, Dick, is go look at the Honeywell website and look up Honeywell wind generators, and it gives you all the specifications on it and everything you need to know about their generating system and the minimum airflow requirements and everything on them. And they're actually some of the first that I've seen where they're really designed for residential use. And for very impressive, by the way. It's relatively a new thing. I think that at one point they were planning on selling them at Home Depot, but I haven't seen them offered at Home Depot yet, but something tells me that that's not too far off. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
I think that might be radio fans. Yeah, but no matter what kind of a fan it is, if the cross-sectional area is 1 meter, 1 square meter, or 1 meter in diameter, 3 foot, to get 5 kilowatts out of that, boy, that would take a lot of wind. Maybe Dennis has already looked into that. NY2HF, K2LIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. Well, I've been getting mind-boggled by all the calculations. But one thing I will say, that if you took 4 of these wind turbines and put them on a roof of your house, they would probably self-destruct in very little time. There's something called dirty wind, where this vortex is created by a structure, whether it be a house or a tree. So you really have to get probably about 25 feet at the least above any of these structures, otherwise you don't get clean wind. And what happens is that they get uneven pressure on the blades, and they self-destruct over time, and very rapidly, matter of fact. As far as how much something produces, it depends on the revolutions per minute that the motor is, the generator actually, is rated at. You know, if it's rated at, 700 RPM, then you're going to be producing a great deal. But if it's rated at 4,500 RPM, you're probably not going to charge your battery. Thanks, Ned.
Hey, YZ, comment. Yeah, YZ, we'll pick you up in a second. I think it was K2YZ. There's kind of an impedance matching going on. I'm guessing that what we call the motor, or what we call the generator, on a wind turbine really is an alternator. And a properly designed alternator, very similar to what's in your automobile, can take fairly high RPM or fairly low RPM, and it readjusts itself electronically by adjusting the strength of the field that's being rotated into that stationary armature that really where the three phases are located. That's in the outer stator accommodated. And without a doubt, you get dirty wind blowing over the trees, over the roof of the house, by the chimney and whatever. In the ideal world, you'd like to have some kind of a tower bringing a turbine up high enough where the wind is more laminar. And the wind will be blowing faster, more pure, and without a doubt, let me drop. A wind turbine system that hasn't been properly designed can easily be destroyed by dirty wind. The eddy currents in the wind and whatever can be flexing those blades in funny ways. However, it is my guess that if you build a robust enough design that it can tolerate, let me pick a number, an 80-mile-an-hour wind, and you're blowing across it with a 35-mile-an-hour dirty wind, if it's made robust enough, I think it can survive and not destroy itself. But my first concern is for the dollars of invested versus feet of diameter of turbine, with normal wind speed you get at your location. I mean, we don't live in the windy city, so to speak. We live here on Long Island, where we do get a lot more wind than they do in certain other places in New York State. But still, is the wind on average going to blow fast enough to give us the right number of kilowatts so that we get return on investment in some reasonable length of time? K2 Yankee Zulu, it sounded like. Correct me and give me your quote, your name, and go right ahead with your comment. K2 LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. John, Kilo 2, India, Zulu, and Copic. Yeah, I'm looking into solar right now, and of course my son says, "Oh, dear, look at this. Go to Home Depot. Here, right here." I'm trying to explain to him. I says, "Andrew, and you just covered a whole bunch of stuff about dirty air. Let me drop this second." Where I had a chimney on the wood-burning stove, and unfortunately, here in Copic, well, it's most of Long Island during the wintertime, the wind comes out of the northwest, and it would blow across the top of the chimney, hit the peak of my roof, and create a nice little vortex there, and I was getting puffbacks through the wooden stove that I finally had to take it out. So, again, the stuff's listed there in Home Depot. They got systems there the whole bit, but, they charge up batteries. And then I had to explain to my son also that, hey, I got a 35-foot tower. I'm below the trees. Last thing that anybody, I think, wants to do all around is put up a 100-foot-high tower on a 60-by-100 plot and put a generator up there. Dick, back to you.
Feeding a vortex like in the Matrix?
KQIQ with a couple of comments here.
Yeah, Glenn recognized. I'd be willing to put up 100 feet of tower, and if I did a good enough job of putting guy wires on it, I know I could make a tower survive 140 mile an hour wind. I think I have done that, so to speak. And in Hurricane Sandy, some pretty high winds with ice the next week followed, and 3,000 pounds of trees landed on one of my guy wires and stretched that guy wire about a foot in a controlled manner. I had adjusted the guy clip so that rather than snap the wire, they would slip a little bit, and about a foot of slippage took place, and the top of my tower tilted a little bit until I readjusted everything. So making a tower survive wind, if you really have enough smarts and mechanical engineering and set up the guy wires correctly, that is doable. And could you put up but now you've got a conflict. To have 100 feet of tower with a real substantial set of guy wires, the guy wires are now in the way of where the blades are going to be for your normal turbine. So that's a conflict. The kinds of self-standing towers that don't have guy wires, the blades have got a nice clearance, but now to make a self-standing 100-foot tower that can take all the torque of the bending moments that the tower is going to experience because of the wind load. I mean, when a turbine is sucking power out of the wind, there is a definite resisting force required. And for all I know, it's going to put a few thousand pounds of horizontal force on the top of your tower, and then you do a little bit of mathification, you know what I mean? You do a little math here as to what kind of stresses in foot-pounds of bending moment you make at the base of a 100-foot of tower with a few thousand pounds of horizontal force at the top, and the numbers get real big, real fast. Can you buy steel that's strong enough and put down a chunk of concrete for the base that's big enough?
Repeater, time out.
There's a lot to be considered, as you can tell. Glenn, I bet you've gone through some of those calculations and figured out whether or not it is reasonable. And can you do it in Massapequa? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
NY2HF with a comment.
Okay, Glenn first and then Dennis in that order. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I think there's some confusion here. When I'm talking about this Honeywell wind turbine, this is not your typical, like, three-blade type of thing. What this thing looks like is it basically almost looks like a bicycle rim where there's no stator in the middle or anything like that, like your typical alternator generator type of thing. How this works is the blades are basically encapsulated around the outside, and so in other words, you have basically like a ring inside of a ring, and the blades are attached to the inner ring. Now, all of the coils and the magnets are on the outside of the blades as they spin through this ring. So as the wind goes through it, all the power generation and all that is basically taking place on the outer ring. There's nothing happening on the center. The center is really just a very, very simple mounting point or a pivot. But all the motor generation and everything is taking place on the whole circumference along the outside of this. It is the most efficient. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at one of the websites for Honeywell's home turbine, and this one was released on 4/21/2011, and this one's rated at 50 kilowatt, but it's considerably bigger than 1 meter across. But the 5 kilowatt, I'm looking at some of the pictures here, and they show simple roof mounting into roof panels, wooden roof panels with brackets. So apparently they're not, you don't need the high towers and all this other stuff. KC2QIQ.
I'm seeing a very interesting relationship here. My son Christopher and I are in the process of getting a little bit more involved in radio control model aircraft, and these electric motors these days, these so-called brushless DC motors, come in generally two forms, in-racer and outer-racer is what I call them, but the highest torque, most efficient motor has the magnet swinging around a ring on the outside of the motor, and the stationary coils are in the middle of the motor, and you get a lot of torque and a lot of efficiency and a lot of ridiculous life. I think you talk about 36,000 hours of survival of that motor, because that's the life of the bearing. There's nothing else there, so to speak. No brushes required, and very fancy. So to build a wind turbine, which really is an outracer brushless DC motor running as a generator, really alternator, I can see what you're describing, Glenn. That sounds like a pretty sexy way to go. And but the word motor has really changed a lot in the last decade. Something that's been around for 100-some-odd years, an electric motor, and all of a sudden, by way of these brushless DC motors with pulse width modulated, three-phase feeding with just the right waveform going to the coils of the brushless DC motor to most efficiently feed electrical power into it and not waste any of it. That's part of what's going on here. Dennis? We ain't heard the end of this story yet, have we? This is a developing technology. NY2HF, K2RAW, you got it, Dennis. Now, wait for the beep set. Wait for the beep set, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. No, I've not heard of this one that Glenn was talking about, but they're always coming out with flavor of the month, and you know, it doesn't seem to stack up. You couldn't use a car alternator because you would have to have so many revolutions per minute. You couldn't possibly get that out of a wind turbine. It's just not going to happen. So you have to go to a permanent magnet motor or some sort of a stator homebrew to generate